This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
My friends, I am Vivian McPeak, and this is Hemp Present. If you have feedback or would like to suggest a guest or topic for Hemp Present, email me at hemppresent@gmail.com. Sheena Roberson is a visionary leader whose journey has been defined by a passion for empowering marginalized communities and promoting inclusivity within the cannabis industry. Before establishing her groundbreaking initiatives, Sheena honed her skills as a corporate leader for Chick-fil-A, where she demonstrated her commitment to community advocacy and outreach. Drawing from her corporate leadership experience, Sheena's heart was called to address the disparities and injustices perpetrated by the war on drugs. She became an ardent advocate for communities disproportionately affected by these policies, recognizing the urgent need for empowerment and support. This catalyzed her journey as a social entrepreneur, setting the stage for the transformative work that she would later accomplish. I have Sheena here today to tell us all about it. Welcome, Sheena, to Hemp Present.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you. I appreciate being a guest.
My pleasure. So Sheena, you used to be a corporate leader for Chick-fil-A. Can you talk about your work there and what skills and aptitude you developed in that role that you were able to transfer over in your work into the cannabis realm?
Well, at Chick-fil-A, I was the sales and marketing director and the director of outside catering sales. So I worked very heavily with some of the largest volume stores in Atlanta, which also garnered being responsible for some of the largest accounts that they held from Coca-Cola and, you know, the Georgia World Congress Center to our movie sets and, you know, the aquarium, right? And so there were there was a lot of responsibility for me to forge strategic partnerships and create opportunities to build and reestablish Chick-fil-A's brand within as many large scale and corporate entities as we could, or organizations that we could. A lot of what I understood to be remarkable experiences and services I garnered from Chick-fil-A. They definitely instilled a level of expectation of quality and a respect for structure and procedure that it definitely helped me develop and build out the skill sets necessary to recreate those remarkable experiences. So Chick-fil-A was very big on emphasizing structure and procedure to make sure that they are giving customers quality every instance, every turn, right? Every time you go to Chick-fil-A, you're met with a smile and a my pleasure, and your food's always great, and there's somebody there with an umbrella if it's raining, and they're taking orders in line. But a lot of that is procedure and built into the system to ensure that quality is across the board, right? And so one of the things that I definitely wanted to make sure I carried over in the sense of what I garnered from that space was that remarkable experience, because cannabis is such a dual faceted space as it relates to like medicinal patients and then sort of what folks like the term recreational use, quote unquote, that, you know, you have to be thoughtful about what kind of experiences you're creating for people and what kind of ways you're looking to connect and provide education or resources or introduce people to different products or services or things. Within this space in particular, it was important for me that, you know, I remembered that, you know, at every instance, you want this to be a remarkable experience for someone, because this may [S2] Right. [S1] Be the first time they're having a conversation about cannabis. This may be the first time that they're willing to listen about what the medicinal benefits could be, right? Or this may be the first time they've heard about terpenes. So, you know, it was always my goal to make sure that, you know, there were remarkable experiences for folks when they encountered ours at every turn.
Was there, you talk about quickly how you made the transition into cannabis and social equity. Was there an event that gave you inspiration, or was there kind of a process that took you from the corporate to the cannabis?
Well, interestingly enough, upon me having to return home after losing my mom, I was in the process of establishing my own consultancy and kind of reemerging myself back into my hometown. And over the course of time, I had made some connections and was invited to a cannabis conference that was happening in the city. And as someone who's like pretty well connected with social service organizations, with event planning, with things that are happening in the city, just from my scope of work before Chick-fil-A, and, you know, community outreach and grant writing, all the things, you know, I'm pretty tapped into what's happening. And I hadn't heard about this anywhere else, or from any other source. And so I thought it was interesting. And then to find out that it was at the convention center, which is the largest venue in the city, to be hosting something like this was even stranger, considering, again, I had not heard anything about it. So upon my arrival, obviously, I was taken aback because this was active conversations about what the landscape of what the cannabis industry would look like in Pennsylvania. And there was no one that looked like me. There were barely any women, and there definitely were no people of color to speak of. And this was agriculture conversation. This was marketing. This was real estate. This was, I mean, so many different conversations and planning and connecting and networking and things happening, and nobody knew this was going on. And so for me, I was surprised and a little obviously offended and upset and trying to figure out how to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again, while also sharing what I just found out. And as I did that, it was just down a rabbit hole of all of the things that just didn't align with what I felt like the cannabis industry should look like, especially considering the impact of the war on drugs on a community that I am from. So that definitely fueled the fire. And I began trying to figure out what was available to people of color and systematically disadvantaged groups, LGBTQI communities, folks that were typically not in the loop of these things. As I wasn't, and how to get this information to them.
You know, I want to talk more with you about your experiences as a woman in the cannabis industry, but after the next break, which is about 3 minutes away. But first, your bio talks about how you were called to address the disparities and the injustices perpetrated by the war on drugs. And the need that you felt to advocate for communities disproportionately affected by those drug war policies. I mean, we know that people of color have been profiled, targeted, and incarcerated at much higher rates than white Americans. But in your words, can you unpack for us a little bit what other kind of impacts has the drug war perpetrated on communities of color and specifically?
That's a good question. I think that when we talk about those disparities, the overcriminalization is the first thing that comes to mind. But there's a lot of outlying obstacles and barriers that are created, for instance, housing, right? And so having a record or having someone who's been incarcerated can affect your ability to access affordable housing if you need it. Social service benefits, Department of Human Services, right? All of these agencies are built around a system that has help destroy a lot of these families and communities. And they're also responsible for the social and economic welfare of said communities. So in that in itself, there's just built-in systematic disadvantage.
And the right to vote, right?
The right to vote, right? And exactly. And I mean, and then if you think about it, we know that the war on drugs has also impacted the community's abilities to get the proper funding and resource support that they need. So we know that these communities have a direct correlation to also having food sovereignty issues, access to preventative care and health care services, a majority of what those communities look like and those target demographics that we hear about that are in need of assistance are also the same demographics that have the highest rate in diabetes and high blood pressure, don't have access to the same opportunities because they are, again, marginalized in the system that is sort of built around them relying on that system. And so it takes services and outside resources and other initiatives for people to be able to tap into to sort of figure out how to work around sometimes the only thing they have to use, right? If you don't have a job that's paying six figures right now, I think everybody can feel the pinch. So imagine someone who does not have the qualifications to get such a job, who is working and making 10 bucks an hour and, you know, can't get a better job because of their record, right? And can't get a better housing, can't get regular housing because of what they make, and but they can't get into affordable housing because of their past, or they can't live with their families because of their past. And so there's layers, and right. That obviously creates mental health obstacles and barriers and things that also are prevalent in this community. So there's down a rabbit hole of all of the things that this touches as we go.
I got to go to a break. So let's hold that for a second. We're going to take a quick break and come back with our second segment with Sheena Roberson.
Time to roll out for the people that let us hemp present. Hang loose. We're coming right back.
We're back on Hemp Present with Sheena Roberson. Sheena, can you talk about your experience not only as a woman in the cannabis industry, but as a person of color? What has that experience been like for you? Are there any experiences or challenges that you've had that you feel are unique to Black women who are active in the predominantly white male cannabis industry? Although thankfully, both of those things are kind of changing as the industry gets more diverse.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's definitely a unique experience for being a woman in this space, and even more so for a woman of color, and particularly me as a Black woman. I am walking into rooms that I know, despite what I offer as an individual, is just undervalued, right? It's just instantly undervalued. Women of color, unfortunately, are not invested in as much as they should be. We are often not promoted as much as we should be. I've been in several situations where a lot of my work was, repackaged for upper management to, take credit for. And all of the effort that's put out, it's not receiving the recognition or the proper, pay or, accolades as everyone else. It's noticeable even when it's done subtly, even when it's done under the guise of something else, it's still very sharp and it's still very noticeable. And so for me personally, this space, although it is, it's yin and yang for me. While I experience some of those same things in the cannabis space, and there is also a special mixture breed of douchiness, for lack of better terms, that can be found in this space, there's also the other side of people who are genuinely in here to do the work and really be an advocate for cannabis and for patients and for people of color and systematically disadvantaged groups. And that's where you find the energy and the strength and the vigor to keep going and to find new ways to survive and thrive in this space, despite all of that. My grandmother always said necessity breeds invention. And so, it is out of the necessity for that safe space for women of color that, the higher conference was even born, because I know that I am not alone in feeling, the unspoken uncomfortableness that others present.
And you're talking about the Higher Women of Color in Cannabis Conference that you founded, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Hire was founded just for that. It's the Hire Cannabis Conference for Women of Color. We are in our second year, happening June 21st through June 23rd of 2024. So I'm very excited. But our inaugural kickoff was last year, and it was incredible. It was such an amazing fellowship of women of all different races, and coming together to have conversations about things that spaces like MJ BizCon just don't cover, right? And some of these larger conferences and platforms that, you know, are being revered and held in high regard as sort of like the go-to things in cannabis that aren't addressing really large obstacles and barriers for women of color that take up a large amount of space in this industry and put in an incredible amount of work. And just deserve as much of a platform as everyone and everything else. And so Hire is a testament, a physical living, measurable testament to the power, resilience, and incredible work that women of color have and continue to do in this space.
You're also the founder of Cannabis Noir, whose mission is to provide a safe and encouraging environment for minorities and overlooked demographics to access the cannabis industry and medicinal community successfully without obstacles.
Yes.
Your words, that's a very important agenda. What are some of the ways that you're making that happen, and what kind of people do you serve?
So our community is vastly diverse. I love the biodiversity and the organic biodiversity of our community. Cannabis Noir is a organization that now has a community in 32 different states. So we have people from all over the country, from all different walks of life that are representing all different types of divisions of policy, of patients, parents. We have the broad band of what the cannabis industry actually looks like. It's such an amazing tapestry of people that have created this wonderfully united front of what our expectations of the cannabis industry and its future should look like. And so we are hosting networking events, and we are creating opportunities for resource-rich and measurably thoughtful and intentful and focused outreach that's designed to empower different communities to either be a part of the cannabis industry, take advantage of the resources that are available, or reap the benefits that most folks should be from who have been adversely impacted from the war on drugs. From that, we actually have a nonprofit called Developing Opportunities and Providing Equity, DOPE, that
nice.
Hosts a career training program, and it connects people who have been adversely impacted in whatever form that looks like to take part in these programs and access opportunities that are beyond like traditional career fairs. And so you know, may not have the skills to, you know, work in tech, but you're an amazing artist. Well, we need to connect you with a place that you can hone those skills. And so we have relationships with places like Rec Philly, Next Fab, which is a creators and maker space, a woodshop and woodworking place, a real estate firm and agency, all of these different spaces that folks can tap into and kind of just hands-on garner measurable, actionable skills to go out and start being a part to go out and start actively taking a part in what they want their life to look like. Because I think a lot of times when we have an expectation of how we want to help people, this is how we are going to help them. We're going to get them this, we're going to get them that, we're going to do this. When in all actuality, all those paths look different because all those people are different. So our job is to figure out what ways we can support those different paths and those different journeys as organically as possible. And so, Cannabis Noir is the organization and sort of the community, and our nonprofit is sort of the resource driven forefront for, you know,
is that
folks.
A C3?
Yes. Yes.
Nice. You know, there's a lot of talk in, you know, about social equity, and the states that legalize have social equity programs, and it often seems to really fall short and kind of mm-hmm. just be, you know, window dressing or messaging. And it sounds like you're doing the actual work to make it, you know, make it happen, right? because a lot of people of color don't know how to enter the industry, and it's probably extremely awkward try to enter this white industry that's mostly men, mostly corporate these days. There's been a lot of carpet bagging, right?
Yeah.
A lot of legacy people have been pushed out of the industry they helped to create.
Absolutely. Tell
us quickly about we have about a minute and a half to the next break. Tell us about the Equity Roadshow.
So the Equity Roadshow is actually a multi-state tour that was designed to go and just have conversations with communities about cannabis and legalization and what that will look like for them, what kind of obstacles or barriers they're faced with, and what kind of instances what kind of interest they have in learning more about cannabis, right? And so it's sort of just an open forum that helps sort of alleviate some of the stigma around it and help introduce people to the understanding that this is how, you know, your civic process works, and this is how this ties into our fight for legalization with cannabis, and ensuring that as these things roll out, that not only are we a part of the conversation, but we're also leading the directives and the narratives. And we do that by educating people of how the system works and how the civic policies work, and how to be active contributors to said system. And so I think the first step in it, though, is getting them to understand and getting them to helpfully explore cannabis at their own in their own spaces, right? And so we go and we pull up and we connect with local community partners and have conversations about what cannabis looks like. And yeah, it's a really great opportunity for people to get out and kind of get to know more about what will be happening in their neck of the woods as it relates to cannabis as well for people who aren't there in the community.
All right. Take another quick break, come back with our final questions for Sheena.
Time to roll out for the people that let us hemp present. Hang loose. We're coming right back.
Back for the third segment with Sheena Roberson. Sheena, what is Burn Blunt Snot Books? I love the name.
Burn Blunt Snot Books is a campaign that we started last year that was in support of literacy campaigns surrounding the book banning. And and so while, you know, I think I love that cannabis is such a segue into so many different ways to have conversations about really important things. And so I thought it would be cool to help people connect the dots in terms of what this book ban could mean and what that looks like. So it's just basically an online campaign, and we're actually going to be picking it back up after Black History Month, and doing a online sort of visual content, digital content course of just different ways that you can support minority authors of color, books that are about subjects that we know that they are trying to ban, especially those that are related around cannabis and the war on drugs and the impact of what that looks like for disadvantaged communities specifically. But yeah, it's an incredible opportunity, I think, for people to learn about how to become more active in some other forms of social justice that we think are really important. You know, I heard that there was a button to there was like a social equity button you had to click just to get books that have minorities or topics about minorities or LGBTQ, for the Scholastic Book Fair, that was kind of like my light bulb that this thing is kind of like bigger than we probably think and deserve some attention. So I was happy to create something around that. We'll work with a bunch of local bookstores and offers, and it's been really cool. In March 2024, we'll be launching again and having a whole series of conversations online with offers and discussing why this is important and ways that people can be a part of saving banned books.
How about the Cannabis Core Social Responsibility Fund?
The CSRP is something that I created very early on as an initial framework of what I thought the cannabis industry should pull into investing. I was extremely new into the cannabis space, but I think that because we have grown in such a way, the CSRP, it just proves that how sound it was at its inception, because it still makes sense to me, right? Because at the end of the day, the social responsibility of corporations is important and people take pay attention to it, right? If you are, you know, a oil tanker and or you are, you know, in big oil and you have an oil spill and there's a bunch of ducks that get hurt and, you know, you invest in Dawn and like figure out how to invest in ducks and the safety of ducks and, you know, oh, we'll work to make sure that our machines don't do this. And even if it's for PR, there's an expectation because you have a social responsibility as a corporation. And I think that that holds true for the cannabis industry too. I don't think you can come into a community, destroy it with the very same product that you are now selling, making millions of dollars for it without some type of restitution back into said community after you dumped oil all over it, right? And so the CSRP was formulated around that thought that as a community, the cannabis industry should be socially responsible, hold themselves responsible as corporations, as companies, as people are taking part and reaping the benefits and of this industry, that they invest back into the oil spills and the, you know, fuck ups of this space prior to.
That's impressive. And we only have about maybe a little over 30 seconds to talk about this. I have been involved in cannabis legalization for 35 years. I must say things have not gone the way many of us envisioned, with mm-hmm. overregulation, excessive taxation, lack of credit and stuff. I know you have some thoughts on legalization in like 30 seconds. Could you give those to us real quickly?
I mean, it's pretty simple. I don't think that, you know, I'm not a fan of the descheduling. I believe that it's a passive aggressive attempt to not do what should be done. I think that, you know, the rescheduling, I think that descheduling it and, you know, so that we're not having this conversation at all, is the only thing that makes sense to me. And I think it's the only way to start off having a real conversation about what all of that restitution does and what all of those walkbacks of the expungements and the harsh convictions. And I think that that's part of the reason why we haven't seen that is because it would be kind of a blatant, you know, hey, we messed up. And yeah, now we have to be responsible for that, and being responsible for things is not something our country has done.
All right, Sheena, our time is up. Instead of schedule one, it needs to be schedule none. Sheena Roberson, found at cannabisnoir.com, and that's cannabisnoire.com. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
That concludes this installment of Hemp Zone Cannabis Radio. The Hemp Present intro music, 7 Mile Beach by Joanne Rand. The outro music, Take Back the Plant by Sticker Bush. Stay strong. Marijuana!